You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Musician Jennifer O'Connor returns to the show this week. She's been making records for almost 20 years, I think, but I first became aware of her with her third album, Over the Mountain, Across the Valley, and Back to the Stars, which I consider a classic. It's been a little while, but Jennifer O'Connor is back with her seventh album, just released. It's called Born at the Disco. Jennifer O'Connor, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
So it's not a disco album, even though it's called Born at the Disco.
Not really, no.
I was all set. You know, I got my, you know, my John Travolta, you know, satin shirt on, and I was ready to dance. And
there's a few that you could do that with.
You were born at the disco, plastic headphones in your ears. You were born in the music, some things never get to be clear.
You know, I think the worst thing anybody could ever ask artists to do is explain their art and what it all means, and I would never do that. But what does it all mean, Jennifer? Why is it called Back to the Disco? What inspired it?
Well, I wrote a song in the title track, and I'm sort of referencing an era, a time growing up. I had an older brother who was really into disco music. Around that time, I you know, he was constantly listening to records with his friends and dancing and stuff. And I think I was young in probably seven or something, but I was watching, you know, and I was like, music, you know? So like, that was kind of, you know, the beginning, I think, of me really that kind of light going on in my head. And so this song is kind of about that time of my life, you know? And it sort of coincides with the fact that I've been listening to a lot of, you know, disco music and funk music. So it's kind of about when I first started listening to and falling in love with music, but also the sound of it. I was purposefully trying to bring in some of that, you know, Giorgio Moroder kind of Donna Summer-esque songs in the, like, the keyboards and stuff, so.
So during the pandemic, say you would sit around and play the Cat People soundtrack or?
Yeah, before that too. But yeah, I'm a big fan.
I love that
soundtrack
too.
Work and stuff, yeah.
Well, of course, your early work, you would think that you would be more like, I don't know, Joni Mitchell, or I don't know, because you play acoustic guitar and you.
Yeah, I love all that stuff too, you know?
Yeah.
I kind of like all of it, and, you know, I've gone through the phases of listening to all kinds of different music, and this has just kind of been something I've been exploring, and I've been sort of exploring recording myself and electronic, like using drum machines and things. So it kind of just happened naturally that I leaned into that a little more with this record.
I might be wrong, but I don't think I hear any acoustic guitar on your new record at all.
You know, some of it, I think the one track where it's just me and the guitar, that is an electric guitar. You're right. There is some that's heavily distorted, so you wouldn't necessarily know it's an acoustic, but some of the tracks that you don't even necessarily know there's a guitar on them actually are guitars that are sort of treated, you know, but I think there's a couple actually acoustic tracks, but it doesn't really sound like what you would think of as an acoustic guitar record at all. No.
So in 10 years, when you release the demos from this, we'll hear the.
Yeah, you know, I was actually thinking about doing that sooner, maybe, because a lot of them could easily be played on the acoustic, for sure.
I love your demo. But,
yeah.
I love hearing your demos, which you occasionally make available decades later. And you own your own record label. This is your label.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I put out my very first record on this label. And then I was on a small indie, and then I was on Matador for two records. And then after that, I put out the last two also on Kayam. Yeah.
So, and you have other artists that are coming out on that label as well.
I do. I haven't put anything else anything out by any other artist since 2019. And I, you know, everything that's happened with the pandemic, I wasn't really planning to, because I needed to finish my own record, but I probably will again, but it's never been a, you know, a huge output. It's been one or two things a year.
Yeah. Well, this has been is this the longest you've gone between releases? Cause I guess it's been about 6 years, right?
It came out in 2016. So 5.5, right?
Yeah.
The one between before that was also 5 years. So I've gotten a little less prolific as I've gotten into my late 30s, 40s. I'm in my 40s now for sure. But I made a bunch of records there when I first started. And, you know, I run a record shop now too. So that kind of cuts into my time a lot. It's a full-time job. And then you put the label in, and then you got to find time to actually write songs and record them. So
do you think you have less to say now that you, or you just don't have the time?
No, I don't. I think I know myself a lot more now, which I think is making me a better songwriter, but I tend to want to work on the songs more now. Whereas before, I think I thought maybe anything that came to my head was worth saying, you know? I think that's an age thing.
Yeah. Well, when you listen to your older things, do you think, oh, they're not finished, or
no,
I could have worked
I just
anymore?
Think it's, I just think the process is different, was different for me as a younger person. I just wrote very fast, you know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that either. I think a lot of my best songs, even now, are ones that happen very fast, but I've gotten a lot more into the craft of songwriting, I think, in the last decade. It interests me more.
A lot of people who put out their first record 20 or so years ago are not making music now. Yeah. So you've really managed to make a career out of it.
Yeah, you know, I've thought about stopping a few times. I just don't think, because it's really hard, you know, it's hard to keep, but I love actually writing songs and making music, you know, it's all the other stuff that can be difficult, you know, just getting it out there, you know, financing it, touring, making a living, doing this or in a combination of other things. It's a lot to balance. But I keep doing it because I love writing songs is the main reason, you know. I think even if the output gets, you know, slower, I don't know that I'll ever stop doing that, just because it's, I think, the way that I actually kind of navigate life, you know. So
well, a lot of us would be very disappointed if you stopped.
Oh, thank you. I know that, you know, I know some people are listening too, and that really does help, you know. I have my little niche, and you know, that is very meaningful to me. So,
well, I want to ask you about something. You, your record is out. I have a CD and I love it.
Thank you. And
you even included a little note, and that meant a lot. Thank you for doing that. But you also, people could buy it as a record. They could buy it as a download, and they can even buy it as a cassette. Are there people who want, why do they want a cassette? Is it a nostalgic thing to put in their Walkman?
Their kids are buying cassettes. We sell them at our store. Younger like indie rock kids are really into it. And I just thought this is the first one we've done for the label. I just thought it might be kind of fun. It's inexpensive compared to vinyl. And I kind of put out a post too. And I was like, you know, I'm going to make vinyl. I'm going to probably make CDs if people still want them. Thinking about making a cassette. And I had a bunch of people be like, make a cassette. So I was like, why not, you know? It's just something fun to have. I only made 100. There's not a lot, you know.
I'm not into downloads. I want to have the physical media, you know, because for one thing, I'm on the radio, but for another thing, what if my internet goes down? Then I won't be able to stream. I want to have it.
Yeah, I agree. I don't. And you've got streaming now too. So if you just want to hear something, like you want to have, it's a record you love. I think streaming is cool because you can test all kinds of things out, but then, you know, if you really like something, you should buy a record or a CD and have it in your library, you know.
Has Bandcamp been a good thing for you?
Yeah, it has. And I've gotten more involved in it the last couple of years. I've had one for a while, but it's become such a scene, you know, online. Like, I think a lot of people, you know, they have the app, they listen, they do buy on, even if they don't, it's a way for people to support artists directly. And it's, there's like a community vibe to it, like almost like a social network. And I think people really enjoy that. And they, all the Bandcamp Friday stuff they've been doing, you know about that.
Yeah, that's when the artists get all the money.
Yeah. So, you know, they don't take any of the cut that they usually take. And I think it really gets people, they're like, oh, well, I'm going to buy a bunch of music this day, whereas maybe they might not otherwise. So it's certainly been good, I think, for artists and labels.
So I am assuming that you haven't been performing live because there was this pandemic. Did you hear about the pandemic?
Yeah, I heard about it. Bummer. And no, I hadn't played since 2019. And then I actually did play a show a few weeks ago because a radio station here asked me to for like their part of their membership thing, and they broadcast it. It was a really good thing to do for the record. So I did. That's the first time I played in like 2.5 years. So it's a little bit weird, but fun.
But you're going to tour now? You're going to do some shows?
That's the plan. Uh-huh. Yeah, all the dates are being booked now, and I'm going to do like a month-long circle around the country. And just me, I made this record pretty much where I play all of it. So, and I've got, you know, things programmed into like my keyboard that I play, and I play along with it, and I play something. It's pretty interesting. It's different, but you know, and I'll play some old songs, just me on a guitar and stuff. So, too.
Yeah. So we might hear, you know, Tonight We Ride or something.
Yeah. 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 I'll probably do like a little bit of a, you know, email blast beforehand, that find out what people want to hear, and do a section of old songs too, for sure.
Your songs are, you know, I mean, I don't know the whole story because that's the way songs are, but they seem very personal, and they are. Yeah. So are there older songs that are harder to play because of personal reasons, or are there like old friends and you don't mind revisiting them, or what's that like?
You know, it depends on the songs. Like there's a, you know, I think that I really don't mind. I mean, all my songs are pretty personal. So I think if that was an issue for me, I would have a hard time doing it at all. I find it to be, I hate to use the word cathartic, but it kind of is, you know, you get to connect. And I think the reason people do like my music, people that like it, is because of that nature, you know? So I think that I've never really had too much of a problem owning that, you know? It's what I do for sure. It's not like, you know, I'm not writing like comedy songs or something, you know. So yeah. You know, I like it feels good to connect with people that way.
Well, I'd like to hear you do a comedy song, but there's a quality in your voice that is kind of melancholic, I think, and I really love that about it. But
thanks.
Is that something that you do you work on your voice? Do you think about your vocal quality?
You mean, do I try to sound melancholic on purpose?
No, no, but I mean, do you do vocal exercises?
Oh, right. No, not at all. No, I learned how to sing by singing along with the radio when I was a kid. Uh-huh. Just loved doing it. And, you know.
And did when your parents were driving you around and you were singing?
No, they were like, stop it.
They didn't say, oh my gosh, you have a remarkable voice, I'm sure.
No,
you're
they
decent.
Didn't. I think one time I remember, it's funny I remember this, but I played basketball in high school, and I remember like I had a Walkman on or a Discman or something, because it was the 90s, and I think I was like singing along, and I think one of my teammates was like, you have a nice voice, and I was like, thanks. But I think that was like the first time anyone ever complimented my singing voice. I didn't come from like a musical family or anything like that, so.
And you didn't start writing songs in your room when you were 13, or when did you start writing?
No, I think I started keeping a journal in around that age, but I didn't start writing songs. I think I started harboring like notions of wanting to in college, but I didn't actually start till after, like a year or two after college, in 96. I joined someone's band that I met at a record store I was working at, and he kind of coerced me into it. And, you know, I learned how to play bass in his band and we did an open mic. I think I actually sang About a Girl by Nirvana at that open mic. And then the next day I wrote my first song. That was the beginning of the end for me.
That's very inspiring. Did you take music lessons when you were a little kid? Did you always learn?
Piano, yeah. Like most kids, you know, with that, you know. And like I said, my brother and his friends were really into music and they were in plays and stuff. And he had a friend in particular who played the piano and he used to teach me some stuff. I learned how to play Moonlight Sonata when I was really young and memorized it. You know, so I played piano and I'd get like sheet music for like, you know, Van Halen songs and stuff. Play Barbara Streisand for my mom, and you know that was kind of the beginning of me learning how to play stuff. And I learned to read a little bit, and kind of put it down, and then didn't come back to it till college. I got a guitar and started learning a couple chords, but wasn't until after I graduated in like '96 that I started.
I was going out. Oh, my mind, do you know how that feels? Barely keeping up with these crimes. I couldn't tell what was real and what was you.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting this week with singer-songwriter Jennifer O'Connor. She's got a brand new album out. It's called Born at the Disco. And we'll be back with more of Jennifer O'Connor right after this.
What was I supposed to do? I never thought it'd really come to this. I never thought the day would really come. And then you came shaking and wet.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we are chatting this week with singer-songwriter Jennifer O'Connor. She got a brand new album out. It's called Born at the Disco. My listeners can't see, but I can see your sparsely furnished dwelling here. And I see you have a record player.
Yes.
Yeah, and you it's fun. I like to play records a lot. I mean, I used to be that was all we had was records when I was growing up.
When did you start DJing?
1976.
So you were doing records then.
I always loved records because you could learn so much from the album cover because it was substantial. You could hold it and read it and all that stuff. What kind of records do you play when you're hanging around?
All kinds of stuff. I play a lot of jazz records, a lot of 12-inch dance records, folk records, rock records.
Do you listen to contemporary music as well?
A little bit, yeah. I don't really buy too much of that stuff on vinyl, but I do some if there's something I really like, which happens, you know. But there's so much old stuff too that I'm still discovering, and that's been really fun at the record store. Like there's just so much that you don't know about, you know.
Do you sell used records there as well?
Yeah, used and new. Yep, and we sell books and clothing and
stuff too. For years I worked at record stores like that.
Yeah. Pretty fun. It's a lot more work than I anticipated when we opened it, but you know,
it's not I used to work at a record store in Santa Cruz called Cymbeline, and we were like the record store that you see in that movie High Fidelity, where we were like super rude. Yeah, we would tell people, don't buy that, man.
No,
that sucks.
It was like this when I was growing up too. So I think we could kind of go out of our way to be a kinder, gentler place.
We went out of our way to be very rude.
Rite of passage, I guess, of the record store back in the day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're starting your live shows in April, and you're going to be in our area at some point. You're going to be in the Bay Area.
Yeah, I'm starting in Boston and going down the East Coast, and then all of down Texas, Arizona, and then I believe L.A., San Francisco.
My favorite song on your new record is called "Less and Less." I just think that is a marvelous song.
You know, you and just about everybody else I talk to. So I guess I really picked the wrong single.
It's looking more and more and more like less and less. Affectations making the front page. We're all so easily undressed. Everyone loves you and your pretty smile. You haven't felt pretty in a while.
What inspired that track?
Well, it's funny because you know how we were talking about the fast, and I wrote that in about 20 minutes. Yeah, that was like one that came super fast. Like whatever it was, I'm trying to say a lot of things, I think, but it was all there. I think I was just, you know, it's born out of frustration of the way, you know, we all live our lives now, I think. And frustration with myself too. And, you know, the things that we devote praise to and like hold up on a pedestal. And I'm trying to think of the lyrics off the top of my head, but just, you know, I think that the things that get attention are often not the things I think should get attention. And then, you know, kind of being your own worst enemy in a lot of ways as well. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah, it's just a, you know, having a hard day about a lot of things, I think, and it just came spilling out. You know?
Well, I've heard songwriters say that some songs are just in the air, and they just are. Yeah. They just, is that how that one came to you? Just like,
I guess,
you just said,
yeah.
Well, yeah.
Sometimes I don't have, you know, sometimes I like, I'll just have a line, you know, which probably is how that one, I'm sure that if it was a song like that, that I wrote that fast, which I remember doing, it just like it, one, it just happened. Like, you don't, there's no, it just comes out of your mouth. Like, I don't even know how that happens. It just does. Which is kind of insane when it does happen like that, but you know that it's in you. There's something in you that you want to say, and that just something in the chord or the melody that you have in your head that just is like a pressing play button, and it's just, you know, it's all there.
When you're making a record like this one, where you're doing it pretty much by yourself and playing all the instruments and so on, do you start with, you know, you're just toying around with the rhythm and you have, do sort of an underpainting and you start layering, or do you start with lyrics and you have an idea? How does that happen?
This one was really not like anything I've done before. And so I didn't have a plan. Like I for a couple of years, really, I was just learning how to use like Logic and drum machines and synthesizers and stuff and sequencing, and was making all these little sketches, I guess you could call them, of like 30 to 60 second pieces of music that had, a lot of them would have drum machines and keyboards or guitars that I distorted, and you know, and I was just doing it for fun, like it's like a new tool kind of, and I amassed like a lot of them, and occasionally, you know, one would spur like a, you know, feeling in me to write around it, you know? So, but most of those songs started like that, like with Not Born at the Disco, that was written on the guitar, and then I sort of transferred it to the other way, but like Who Can You Kiss and what else? Carrying You. These are songs that I kind of made that instrumental beat you know, and then that turned into like, then I would write a song around like a, you know, 16 bar loop or something. And that would be like the verse, and it's often the verse and the chorus, because it was almost like, I think I was talking to someone else about it. It's almost like I was painting these little pictures, and then I would sort of take the picture and turn it into a song. But I didn't really know what I was doing, so it kind of took a long time to figure out how to write a song in this new way. And then there's some stuff that I just wrote, like the guitar and the piano and stuff, that are more traditionally how I would do it. But yeah.
So in some ways, the pandemic was good for you because you could hang around the house and make this record.
Well, actually, most of it was done before. Yeah, I mean, I finished it kind of. I decided to, like, I added parts and bridges and stuff. And then in the summer of 2020, I started taking it to the studio I used to work out of and finishing up, like, doing vocals that needed to be done there. And with the person I worked with the last couple of records, this guy, Tom Beaujour, who plays in my band when I do band stuff sometimes too. So he kind of helped me tie it all together. But most of the songs were all written before the pandemic. I had planned on putting it out in 2020, finishing it, and, you know. But yeah.
Well, it's good. It's really good. Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Born at the Disco, it's brand new, from Jennifer O'Connor. But there's also I Want What You Want, and Surface Noise, and Here With Me. I love Here With Me so much. What a wonderful record it is. And the one that I consider your first one, even though it's your third one, Over the Mountains, Across the Valley, and Back to the Stars. I remember reading an article in New Yorker about you when that record came out, in which they said that it was one of the most perfect records ever made, or something like that. That must have felt good.
Yeah, it did feel good. I remember getting a copy of it on tour, being like, what? Those things, when they happen, which isn't often, but when they do, it's cool because you can like tell your mom and you can show your mom and dad. You know?
Yeah. So there's lots of places that people could get this, but the best would be to just go to your website, which is.
Yeah, you can go to getkayamrecords.com. You can get it at bandcamp.com. And, you know, it's on all the streaming services. And hopefully it'll be in some stores soon, too.
It's probably in your store. What's the name of your store?
Well, my store is Main Street Beat. You can get it there too on the website, and visit us in Nyack, New York.
Main Street Beat in Nyack.
Yeah, the vinyl won't actually be here until like mid-December, but the rest of the rest is here.
Jennifer O'Connor, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I was hiding in plain sight. Nothing to make right. Are you forever done with pleasing everyone? You were looking for someone easy to run from, and I was your guy. All the stars in the sky collide and lie.
Singer, songwriter, record store owner, entrepreneur, Jennifer O'Connor. Her latest album is called Born at the Disco. You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll be back with more right after this. This is KSCO Santa Cruz. I'm Gary Shapiro, and you are listening to From the Bookshelf.
Get back, get together. Get back home. Oh, we gotta get together.
The Beatles, they've been on my mind lately. I've been watching the fabulous 7.5-hour Peter Jackson film, The Beatles, Get Back. And just the other day, I was visiting on Good Morning Monterey Bay with Rosie and Alex Schaefer, and I had a conversation about The Beatles on film. And here it is.
Sounds like a wedding.
Oh. Ring those Christmas bells. Ring those Christmas bells. While we chime, we'll have a happy time. So ring those Christmas bells.
Ring those Christmas bells by Fred Waring and his Pennsylvanians.
Oh, the Pennsylvanians.
Yes, exactly.
All righty. Well, that's very good. Yes, ringing bells. I think we need music for January. I think this is something I'm thinking about, that, you know, we have to have January music. Anyway, as Alex sprints down the hall past the newly renovated pool, I have to say, and joins me here in the studio, and we have Gary Shapiro joining us on the phone, and we're talking movies. Morning, Gary.
Good morning, and Fred Waring is in the Pennsylvanians. That's what I want to talk about today, actually.
Oh, really? What are the odds?
Actually not, but how are you?
I'm doing very well. Yeah, I'm doing great. I put in a gas stove oven yesterday, and it actually works. So I'm feeling pretty successful, moderately manly, and handy around the house.
Well,
how about you?
I would have hired a guy to do it.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. It was an achievement of sorts. A little too much patting myself on the back, I should say.
Maybe. You deserve it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
The movie that I've been obsessed with all week is Peter Jackson's film, Get Back, The Beatles, Get Back. Have you seen any of it?
I have not seen any of it. Is it readily available on the streaming stuff?
If you are a Disney Plus subscriber, then yes, it is.
Oh, I am not, but maybe I should be. I've heard nothing but rave reviews.
It's a definitive
documentary, right?
Yes. I want to talk a little bit about the Beatles films, because I think people who have been watching this thing like me might be interested in what other Beatles films there are. And in fact, the Beatles, when they were the Beatles together, made 3 films. Unlike Elvis Presley, who made 31 films, or Frank Sinatra, or Bing Crosby, or Al Jolson, who all made multiple films, the Beatles made 3.
And I'm only familiar with one, I think, which would be The Yellow Submarine.
That is not a film that the Beatles made.
Oh, no.
In 1964, when the Beatles were at the height of Beatlemania, United Artists decided that it would be smart to make a Beatles movie, because they could then put out a soundtrack album with Beatles songs on it and make a ton of money.
Uh-huh.
Also knew that they had to do it quickly, because people would forget about the Beatles by 1965. So they better do it as fast as they can.
Ridiculous.
So they made a movie, and it was called A Hard Day's Night.
Ah, of course.
And it was directed by an American living in England, whose name is Richard Lester. And he was a very fine and funny filmmaker, and got the Beatles' attention because he had made some comedy films, including a short called The Running, Jumping, Standing Still. And they loved comedy. They especially loved Peter Sellers and the Goon shows, and they loved Markham and Wise on television. And in some ways, Hard Day's Night is made in that style. The guy who wrote the screenplay, Alan Owen, followed the Beatles around for 10 days or so, and then wrote a screenplay in which the Beatles simply play themselves on tour. And everybody thought this would be a forgettable movie like, Beach Blanket Bingo or something. But in fact, it was instantly hailed as a classic, because it is, in fact, a classic. It's one of the greatest movies ever made. It's funny. It's sharp. It's social commentary, and it's got some great Beatles performances in it. The Beatles perform a bunch of songs, and it's a really fine film in glorious black and white.
And it revolves around crazy things happening backstage, right, behind the scenes during their tours.
They're on tour, and they're moving from they're going to do a television show. That's what's happening, and there's no real plot in the film, but it has some wonderful actors, some wonderful British actors in the film, as well as the Beatles, and it's just a great, great film, and it's available on Blu-ray from Criterion, so you know it's going to be good, because the Criterion company puts out really good movies on really good Blu-ray, and in fact, they are about to release it again in the 4K UHD, the ultra-high definition Blu-ray, too, so it's a good time to pick up Hard Day's Night. If you've never seen it before, you know, whenever my film students ask me, what's your favorite movie of all time? I say, well, it's hard to say because I love so many movies, but A Hard Day's Night is right up there in my top tier of great films. A year later, the Beatles made a sequel, and it's called Help. And Help is not as great as A Hard Day's Night, because it would be hard to make any movie as great as A Hard Day's Night, but it is excellent. It's really, really funny and fun. It is a satire on James Bond films.
Really?
Yes, and it was made in full color, because, I mean, A Hard Day's Night was such a huge success that now they realized, oh, this isn't a flash in the pan, the Beatles are here to stay, let's give them a star treatment and let them do, you know, whatever they want. Again, directed by Richard Lester, and the Beatles hop around the world being pursued by evildoers in a James Bondian kind of way.
And these movies were named after the songs, or vice versa? Or
Beatles wrote songs for the film.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it was part of a soundtrack, actually.
I mean, they didn't know what the title of A Hard Day's Night would be. And they had been working all day, and they walked out into the sunlight, and Ringo Starr said, "Whoa, it's been a hard day's night." And that they thought that was such a funny phrase that they used it as their title. And originally, Help was going to be called Eight Arms to Hold You. And in fact,
wow.
there's a 45 that even says from the film Eight Arms to Hold You. But instead, they called it Help after one of John Lennon's songs, actually. And Help is also just delightful, wonderful, hilarious film with some great performances of Beatles songs, including Help. And it's great. It's absolutely great. So they made those two films, and everybody thought, okay, well, they're going to follow in the footsteps of other great pop stars and make a ton of movies. But they never did. They never made another one until 1969.
Despite the blockbuster success of the first two.
Yeah. In 1969, well, they kind of, you know, they never did anything again. They weren't that kind of group. They never, like, if something was a success, they didn't go, oh, well, let's do that exact same thing again.
Right, like all of their albums are fairly different.
Everyone is different.
Yeah.
And they did make a television film in 1968, which was called Magical Mystery Tour. It was made for television. It was going to be shown on ABC in the United States, and it was shown on BBC. But it was made in color, and it was made when they were experimenting with recreational drug use. And if you happen to be on LSD when you're watching it, I think you'd find it delightful, but anybody else would find it kind of a bore. And also, when they broadcast it in 1968, they broadcast it in black and white in England, and it was got all the psychedelic colors.
Right.
So broadcasting in the black and white was kind of lame. And it did so poorly and got such bad reviews that it was not shown in America at the time. It wasn't shown in America for many, many years until finally, like in the 1970s, people started to see it in movie theaters.
And in color.
It's in color. It's not terrible. It's fine, but it doesn't count as one of their films.
Right.
Kind of a TV thing. But then they made this movie called Let It Be, which was shot with them in the process of making their album, the album that eventually became Let It Be. And it's an 80-minute movie directed by a guy named Michael Lindsay Hogg, and you can't see it. It hasn't been available for viewing
for
many years. It was around as a VHS tape at one time. I saw it in the theater in 1970, and it was great. And then it's kind of disappeared and has a bad reputation. The director, Michael Lindsay Hogg, had shot 60 hours of film that he edited down to the 80-minute movie, Let It Be. And that is the source that Peter Jackson has used to make his new film, The Beatles Get Back. And I'm thinking that probably after everybody has seen Get Back in the next year or so, we'll see a copy of Let It Be return, because Let It Be is an 80-minute cutting of this 8-hour Peter Jackson film.
So was it a documentary, Let It Be?
Yes, a documentary with them at work. And it seems like they are in the process of breaking up, but that was because between the time they shot the film and the time the film was released, they broke up. But if in Peter Jackson's film, you can see that they are, it's not about a group breaking up. It's about a group recording an album, a group of musicians who love each other and are incredibly talented and have a lot of fun and occasionally bicker. And some of that bickering is in the movie Let It Be, but because the movie Let It Be is only 80 minutes long, as opposed to 8 hours long, the bickering takes a larger role in the movie.
But right? unless you go to, you know, off-brand corners of the internet, it is not actually available currently.
Yes, there is no official. Yes, you could definitely find a bootleg, but there is no official copy of it available. And the thing about Peter Jackson's film is he's restored all of the original footage, so that in The Beatles Get Back, everything looks like it was shot yesterday, and it's beautiful and it sounds beautiful. And your bootleg version of Let It Be is not going to reflect that. And even the official version of Let It Be was kind of murky because a lot of it had been shot in 16mm and blown up to 35mm.
And so since this is sort of the six-hour documentary phenomenon and it deals with the breaking up of the Beatles?
Well, it doesn't really deal with their breaking up. It deals with them making an album.
Okay.
And it's a great, it's absolutely delightful. I mean, there is some tension between them, but, you know, there's also tons and tons of joy and happiness and love. Now, you mentioned Yellow Submarine, so let me just talk about that.
Okay,
really.
Sure. Yeah, please, we got a minute.
In 1968, they made an animated film called Yellow Submarine, which the Beatles had nothing to do with because they were turned off to the whole idea. There had been a lame 1960s Beatles cartoon show, Saturday morning cartoon show, that they had nothing to do with. And then when they saw Yellow Submarine, they thought it was groovy and were happy that they made it, and so they appear in it briefly, but it's not their voices, and they did contribute some songs to the film.
They didn't do the voiceovers for their own
likeness. No, actors do their voices.
Really? Did they do a good enough job? Did it?
Oh, no, of course not.
It didn't hoodwink anybody. No.
But it's a great movie. It's a lot of fun. But it's not an official Beatles movie in that way.
Okay. And my last question is, do you blame Yoko for them breaking up?
Of course not. I admire Yoko Ono very much. Yoko Ono didn't have any role in their breaking up. That was all up to them.
Okay. It's all before my time, so I always wonder if that's the real deal or not. It's just
the deal is. Four boys who got together when they were teenagers, went their separate ways when they were 30 years old.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, wild. Okay, so these are new Blu-rays that you can find that have the first two movies on them?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, lovely. I'll have to dive in. Maybe I'll see if I can do 6 hours of a documentary about the Beatles.
It's eight, and it's fantastic. You'll love it.
Sold. All right, thanks for talking to me, Gary.
Bye-bye. Talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. That's Gary Shapiro. You can get Gary Monday nights at 7 from the bookshelf. Then you can get him Tuesday on Noon Balloon from 12 to 2. And then every other week we do books and we do movies. And he is great.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.